Welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression. I'm going to be your host tonight, Tom Perry. I'm also joined by one of our regulars from Utah County, John Larson. What's up, John?
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Doing good. Thanks for joining me, man.
Thanks for having me.
And tonight's guest, let's just call him Bishop. We're going to keep his identity kind of hidden for obvious reasons. We're not going to expose his name or where he lives or anything like that. We'll kind of go through that in the discussion here. But Bishop, thanks for joining us on the show tonight.
Oh, it's great to be with both of you. Thanks for having me.
But first, I guess we should hurry up and explain this. But you're a current active serving bishop as of today, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm currently a bishop. I'm the bishop of my ward, and it's really been a great experience, but also one of the most challenging experiences of my life. So I am a bishop.
How long have you been bishop?
Well, let's just put it this way. I'm not a novice bishop. I'm not at the beginning of my term. Yeah, I've been through the bishop thing, and I've also been in previous unit presidencies. So, you know, I'm familiar with a bishopric and branch presidency and how that operates. But now I'm the bishop. So.
All right. Well,
there it is.
That's great. So I guess most of our audience is probably thinking, how is it that an active bishop is on Mormon Expression? I guess we should go ahead and explain that you've kind of struggled a little bit. I know that I found you on one of the boards online. You've kind of experienced, I guess, what's the cliche is called, like a crisis of faith, or gone through kind of a doubting phase. Did that happen to you while you were a bishop, before you were a bishop? How did that kind of play out?
Well, I think like a lot of people, there's no really one event. Well, maybe some people have one event, but for me, it's been kind of a series of different things that led to a crisis of faith. Probably the first thing that happened was happened several years ago. When I was working and I had an evangelical Christian friend kind of witness to me or confront me that I worshiped Adam. And I, being a little on the naive side, I suppose, I had never heard of such a thing, and I said, that's just a lie. I don't worship Adam. That's where are you getting that from? Well, your prophets have taught you that you worship Adam. I'm like, no, they haven't. That's crazy. So that was kind of a shocker for me that you know, somebody was saying such things. And so you know, I go, well, I don't worship Adam, and then she said, well, you have to, because you must be obedient to the prophet. So I went away with that, being a little annoyed because she's my friend, and it was really an awkward situation. And as the internet started to become more you know, ubiquitous and people using it, I began to explore, you know, that we do have that history of the Adam God doctrine, as most of your listeners probably know. And you know, I was on the farms and fair sites to kind of try to figure out how to deal with that. And I just said to myself, well, these are very intelligent individuals on farms and fair, and they've already kind of worked it out. And, you know, I just kind of went with the prophets are fallible. So that was one major event. The other thing was, you know, I began to, just in the course of my life, talk with people of different faiths, and I've had the opportunity to, you know, just interact and meet a lot of people, both online and then out there in the real world. And I began to see that they were having spiritual experiences like I was. And I really have felt that I've had spiritual experiences in my life that have transcended, you know, just mere emotion. They've been something special, and the way I interpreted them is it must mean that the church is true, that it's all true.
Right,
and that's how I interpreted those experiences. But then I started to recognize that other people were having, you know, very spiritual experiences, some of them very similar to mine. And the interpretation that they were getting was that the course that they were on was true. And so you kind of have to try to say to yourself, okay, well, am I really going to say that my course is better than theirs? Am I really going to say that their spiritual experience came from Satan? Am I really going to treat them that way? And then kind of the golden rule comes into play at that point. How would I want to be treated with those things? So that just starting to recognize that my own situation and the situation with those in the church as far as feeling the Spirit or having spiritual experiences was not unique, that other people are having those experiences with their own faith tradition. And, of course, many of them are feeling that confirmation that they're on the right course in their lives. And I kind of wondered, well, if this is the true church, why would God do that? Why would he give others spiritual experiences and allow them to interpret that they're on the right course if we have all the truth? So that was kind of the second part.
You started feeling this way a while back, like before you got called as a bishop, Zach. That's right?
Yeah, that's correct. And then getting close to when I was called as being bishop, I had some very good friends leave the church. And these were active members of the church. Two of them were born in the covenant, and it was devastating to me. I was angry. I felt betrayed. It hurt. I didn't understand why they were leaving the church. I knew that they had struggled with some things, but I never thought that it would come to the point that they would just leave.
Did you feel betrayed by them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was angry. You know, I felt betrayed by them. I felt, hey, that, you know, do they think that they're better than me and everyone else here? Are they smarter than me? Do they think they know something more than I do? You know, what's so bad about things that you got to leave? So, you know, that really upset me, and it hurt for a long time. But as I kind of got over it, I began to say, okay, these are very intelligent people. They're good people. I know they're good people. Why did this happen? You know, I began to ask that question. And I began to also come across this myth that is really such a damaging, horrendous thing that we throw out there, that if somebody leaves the church, it must mean that they're involved in sin, or that they, you know, they have a desire to sin. And at first I just kind of swallowed that and said, yeah, I guess maybe that might be the case. But as I've come to learn and come to understand why somebody leaves the church, and, you know, some of the work of John Dell and other pioneers in this area, I began to learn why, and it made sense to me. And I think a lot of people with the church history and the policy of faith promoting church history, there's this Grand Canyon between the faith promoting history and the other parts of the history that are maybe not so faith promoting, and people are trying to jump that like Evel Knievel, and they don't make it, and so they're injured. And then as they leave the church and deal with these injuries that come from this big gap between the faith promoting history and the totality of our history as a people, we insult them. We accuse them.
Did you find out why your friends had left? Was it intellectual or church history reasons, or something else?
You know, and this is the hard part, is that in our, as a people, we can't really talk about this in a safe way. We don't know how to talk about it in a safe way. You don't talk about it. And if you do, you run the risk of almost becoming getting spiritual leprosy. You know, people start looking at you like a spiritual leper. Let's head for the hills, because I don't want to get contaminated with that. So, to this day, I haven't really gotten into the details with them about why this happened. We have cordial relationships now. It was hard at first, but I hope one day that there'll be some space for us to be able to talk about it. But it's taboo, as a people. It's something that we don't have space to be able to talk about, or to share certain questions or certain doubts. We don't have the space for that, or the safety to be able to do that at this point. And that's why I think we see all this action on the internet, is because the internet does give you that opportunity to do that anonymously. But we can't do it out in the open. A lot of times it's just not safe.
You sound frustrated that there is no space within the church. Are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I am frustrated, because when I think about us as the Church of Jesus Christ, I kind of think, how would he deal with this situation? And as you know, there's a story where, a man brings his son who has palsy to Jesus to have him healed, and Jesus senses that the father doesn't have faith, or is struggling with faith or doubt. And so he kind of throws that out there. And the father says, if you can do anything for us, please have compassion on us. Jesus, of course, in the story, heals the child. So I think the way we treat people who leave the church, or people who are about to leave the church, or people who are starting to ask questions or have doubts, we don't treat them very well. We don't have compassion on them. And to me, that's wrong. It's not what the gospel of Jesus Christ is about. It's fundamentally, it's about love and compassion. Regardless of what the decisions of the individual make, we need to have that compassion, whatever they choose to do. But instead, we do things like, you just need to pray a little bit more. You're not praying enough. You're not giving enough effort. You're not reading the scriptures enough. You're not doing it the right way. You're sinning. or you have a desire to sin, and you're just not admitting it. So we add insult to injury. You know, they've been injured by this gap, and they've also been injured, and many times, as I've learned more, they've been injured by ecclesiastical abuse, where a unit leader has engaged in what I would consider to be an abusive situation, using his authority as an ecclesiastical leader to, you know, sometimes bully or coerce or exercise unrighteous dominion. And oftentimes these folks don't feel like they have any recourse anywhere they can go. And to me, that's not okay. If you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you need to stand up against things that are unjust. We need to do a better job of reaching out to those who are struggling.
Well, I wouldn't mind diving into that a little bit later as well. Maybe with additional questions we'll ask. But I'm curious, where are you now, Bishop? Do you see do you believe in the church's claim of authenticity? Where do you stand on the doubt scale?
I think that's an excellent question, and I'm still sorting through that. That's a constantly evolving process. What I can tell you is that when you start to find out that the church and individuals in the church, the brethren, the prophets, are not exactly what you thought they were, and you start to put those pieces together, it's truly one of the most horrendous experiences of your life, especially for someone like me who has, you know, put the brethren on a pedestal, and particularly Joseph Smith. And when you do that, and then you start to dig deeper, that pedestal can come crashing down pretty hard. And it really had a very, very hurtful negative effect on me. I almost call it an internal earthquake in a diverse place. And it rocks you. And it even affects your health. You know, I'm a big fan of Lord of the Rings, and it almost reminds me of how the dwarves delve too deeply. And if you delve too deeply into any institution, any individual, I don't care what it is or who it is, you dig deep enough, and you're going to find a Balrog. And you're going to have to do battle with it. And chances are you might be able to kill it, but chances are you're going to be killed in the process too. But as Gandalf says, that's only a new door to another place. So my internal Gandalf the Grey is dead. But I feel like my Gandalf the White has been resuscitated here, and I'm able to move forward and get a semblance of my life back. I remember one particular situation to give you kind of a graphic or a picture of what I went through. I was going through the gospel art kit, and that we often use for family home evening, and I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with it. And I pulled out a picture of Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery sitting there at the table with the gold plates on the table right there. And I looked at it, and I told my wife, "This isn't true. This picture is not true." You know, because I'd never heard of any hat being involved in this whole thing before. when I saw the picture, I realized that, you know, this isn't true.
How was that received?
My wife has been, you know, for the most part, pretty supportive. She's a very pragmatic individual. She knows some of the she probably knew more of the complexities and issues with church history than I did. And she, you know, for her, it works for her. And she feels the spirit and, you know, she feels more or less good. And that's an important thing to understand, is that a lot of times we're kind of in our own bubble. And when you're on a board, too, you can kind of be in that bubble, too. And, you know, I got to remind myself that everybody is having a unique subjective experience with a church. And so it's awfully hard to paint things in a broad brush and say, okay, this is how it is for everybody, because it's not. Everybody kind of lines up on this quadrant of orthodoxy and orthopraxy. And we all find ourselves in a unique position in those quadrants. But when I saw that picture, it really blew me away. And I went upstairs and I took a shower. And this may sound a little odd or strange to your listeners, but you know, I was getting my garments out and you know, to put them on. I was just kind of sitting on the bed. And I started to break down. And, you know, the tears were flowing. And I just felt myself feeling such a sense of loss. You know, it's like taking yourself back to when you were a little primary boy, you know, and you sing the Golden Plate song and Book of Mormon stories and, you know, things like that. And, you know, you have such an idealized and romanticized view of things, and then to have reality confront you, it's devastating. So I started to cry and mourn. But I took my top garment and, I don't know, I've never done this before. I don't know why I did it, but I kind of used it to wipe my eyes. I kind of cried into the top of my garment. And hopefully nobody, none of your listeners are picking up stones for blasphemy here or anything like that. But, you know, I wiped my eyes with it. And as I thought that, as I kind of thought about it, because the garment for me symbolizes Jesus Christ, of course, and, you know, it helped me remember that in the millennium, he'll wipe away our tears. So when I did that, that symbolism of Christ wiping away my tears gave me some strength. And, you know, the message that I got from that is, you know what, it's going to be okay. Hang in there. It's going to be okay. So it's a constantly evolving thing, but all I can tell you is it's been one of the most painful experiences in my life.
Do you still view the garments in that way, and also a belief in Jesus?
Yeah, I still feel very comfortable with Jesus Christ and his teachings. The garment for me is symbolic, as everything in the temple is or should be. And that's another thing that I've kind of learned, is that whether it's very, very orthodox Mormons, or a lot of the Mormon or Mormons that are disaffected that I've come in contact with, you know, they have this view of the garment and things going going on in the temple as very literal. And that's another thing that kind of has affected me, is that I began to look at everything that goes on in the temple to be symbolic. Everything. And, I probably, like most people, I looked at a lot of the things in a literal way. You know, I looked at Adam and Eve in a literal way. I looked at, you know, the temple clothing in a literal way. I looked at the covenants you make in a very literal way. And, you know, as I did some more reading and looked at a few blogs, my mind kind of was open to see things in a symbolic way. And that really has, that's been, you know, one of the best things that's happened in this experience, and probably is something that is going to help me to maintain my journey in the church, is that I do feel that the church and the teachings of the church and the temple have deep symbolic meaning, that if you're able to kind of dig in and plumb the depths of that and look for deeper and profound symbolism beyond the literal and the superficial, it truly has blessed my life and has helped me to continue forward.
So, Bishop, as your faith has sort of evolved here, and you've learned to take a more metaphoric interpretation of the gospel and the church, how would you compare your, you know, the satisfaction or the spirituality you get out of your faith today as before, when it was more literal? Do you feel that it's become more spiritual for you or less?
That's a good question. I have to live in the day-to-day world of being a Mormon and being a bishop. And so, a bishop is very, a very busy person. He's responsible for the ward. He needs to look out for each ward member. And he's also has responsibilities to the church, and he's got a nice thick policy manual that he needs to be familiar with. So there's some parts about, you know, being a bishop and being a member of the church where it's very, very challenging, very difficult. But the metaphorical aspects and the symbolic aspects are very nourishing, you know. And so you take something like the gold plates hidden in the hillside. You know, we used to sing that song in primary, the golden plates lay hidden deep in the mountainside. So you take that as a metaphor that you are the mountainside, you know, that you are the hill Cumorah, that that what you're trying to get is this the gold plates that are deeply hidden within you, and your divine nature and your higher self, the truthfulness of who you are, and that as you go through some difficulty and some effort, you're finally able to retrieve the plates and begin the translation process, which isn't easy. And as you're able to translate that and find out how to be true to yourself, you become the most correct book on earth. So whether something is literal or not, that doesn't become the issue for me. It's how can I find meaning in the symbols that are from my people. And I'm finding that I'm able to do that, and that it's enriching my life and helping me.
You know, I applaud this approach. For me personally, you know, I've slowly had to take that approach, you know, take things less literal, take things more metaphorically. But I find myself, when I'm at church, in a constant battle with those that take things literal. Because, I don't know, I tend to think that the members of the church, maybe it's a majority, are, you know, take things very literally. There's only a small minority of members of the church that look at these things as stories or as a metaphorical kind of thing. So if you're a bishop and you're in the minority in your ward and you're constantly battling with a good percentage of members that are taking things literal, that's got to be a constant battle for you.
I think that's an excellent question. I think that even though somebody may take it literally, they can still see some type of symbolic meaning for themselves. So it's not always a battle. But you're right. You know, the more literalistic somebody is, the more legalistic somebody is, you know, the harder it is for me as a bishop. And much of the time when somebody is very literal and legalistic, they have what I call kind of the scribe and Pharisee mindset, you know, because the scribes and Pharisees were very much literalists and legalists. And, you know, you take, for instance, the story of Nicodemus, and, you know, Jesus tells him, you know, you need to be born again. Well, in this day and age, almost everyone, Christian or not, kind of understands the meaning of born again, right? But for Nicodemus, what did he say?
Remind me. You're the bishop.
He said, how can I be born again? Is it actually possible to crawl back in the womb a second time?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that's literalism. And Jesus was constantly using symbolism and parable. And so if we're followers of Jesus, we need to really understand how to use symbolism and parable, how to understand it, how to see it, because, you know, that's his language. And, you know, you got other things too, where, you know, he said, you need to eat my flesh and my blood. Now, most people today understand, yeah, he's just using symbolism there. But at the time, a lot of people didn't understand that. After he said those things, a lot of his disciples couldn't deal with that because they took it literally. So you're right. There is some battles that kind of need to be fought on this ground, and I think I do think that as the church goes forward, there will be kind of this how do we address legalism in the church and literalism in the church. And because literalism and legalism, in my opinion, and I'm not speaking for the church, I'm speaking for myself right now, that sucks the spirit right out of the equation when it comes to spirituality. The letter of the law kills, and it's the spirit of the law and the spirit and the symbolic meaning that are truly important and nourishing. So you're right, there is some battling, but you know, the good part about when you're bishop is that you can kind of steer the agenda. And so for me as a bishop, you know, I really focus on being Christ-centered and, you know, centering things on Christ and his teachings. And I feel like that's really territory that I think most Orthodox members and even members who are very, very disaffected, you know, a lot of them feel comfortable in that territory. That's kind of the common ground.
As far as you're concerned, I mean, you're obviously in kind of a privacy situation, so maybe you can feel a little more forthcoming with some of your answers. But as far as literalism is concerned, there's certain things in order to be a member of the church you have to take as literal. Like, you have to believe that Joseph Smith saw Heavenly Father and Jesus in the first vision, or that, you know, that he translated the Book of Mormon. I mean, there's got to be some areas where you're like, okay, that happened.
When you look at the temple recommend questions, the temple recommend questions are really kind of the minimum standard, almost, that we would say, that, you know, the church would hope that we would be able to follow. Those temple recommend questions are very interesting. They do not, a lot of them are not very specific, are they?
Some aren't, but some are. Some are specific.
Some aren't, and some are, but yeah. let's take the ones that you mentioned. There's no question in there that actually mentions the name of Joseph Smith. You do ask, do you have a testimony of the restoration of the gospel? Now, remember, what that means to one person might not mean exactly the same to another person. And I don't believe that we live in a completely objective world. We're subjective beings. And so nobody has quite the interpretation of what the restoration is as someone else. And that can mean different things to different people.
Okay, so there's some fudge room there, but one of the questions is, do you believe or sustain the current living prophet as a prophet, seer, and revelator, right?
Right.
And that one, to me, doesn't have a whole lot of fudge room.
Yeah, I think that might be hard for a lot of people, but what if the word prophet has symbolism? What if the word seer has symbolism? What if the word revelator has symbolism? And what if it's a metaphor or parable for you?
Maybe.
Because ultimately, as you know from the scriptures, there's a story with Moses where somebody is prophesying in the camp, and the people are kind of getting upset and saying, hey, this guy's prophesying in the camp, these people. And Moses says, you know what? Don't worry about it. I wish that everyone here was a prophet. Right?
Okay.
So I'll try to connect the two here. So you're looking at a model, really, of what a prophet, seer, and revelator is. And, you know, for me, those are titles and, you know, have deep symbolism involved in them and tell me something about who I am. The other thing I would say, too, is that one of the major purposes of a prophet is that they are to testify of Jesus Christ. The Book of Mormon says all prophets testify of Jesus Christ. That's their main role, is to invite all to come unto Christ. Now, I think we lose some of that, obviously, because, of course, as we know from church history, prophets are fallible, no question about it. And we do hold them up on pedestals, and we do lay things on them that, you know, we probably shouldn't. But, you know, prophets are fallible.
Yeah, but that's a slippery slope. I've gone back and forth on the prophets as fallible in my own head, back and forth, and it's tough to go from one extreme to another. If you say fallible, what exactly are they capable of doing?
Yeah.
Are they actually capable of committing adultery and still be considered prophets, you know, or, God forbid, murder? You know, it gets into
right.
A pretty slippery slope. So I do understand what you're saying, but that makes it tough. But just to go on to the temple recommend questions real quick, since you're a bishop, and I'm sure maybe you've experienced this, maybe you haven't, a member of your ward comes up, wants a temple recommend, and says, well, Bishop, I don't think the Book of Mormon is historical, and I think the Book of Abraham should be thrown out of the scriptures. Can I still have a recommend? What do you say about that?
Well, what I would say is, you know, the question here is, do you have a testimony of the restoration of the gospel? You see, and that's the thing that bothers me is I know for a fact there's a lot of unit leaders that alter the temple recommend questions in spite of being told over and over again that they're not supposed to do that. It's supposed to be a very simple process where you ask these questions and the person, according to their conscience, answers those questions. I'm not going to get into the specifics of each individual thing, but I'm going to ask the person, do you have a testimony of the restoration of the gospel? Now, again, what that means to one person can mean something totally different to someone else. There's a reason why the brethren did not put in there, do you have a testimony of the literalness of, the prophet Nephi in the Book of Mormon? Or do you have a testimony of the literalness of the Book of Abraham? There's a reason why they have those temple recommend questions as they are. And to me, they're very general in a lot of ways and can be interpreted in lots of different ways.
So it's kind of a game of semantics, sort of, right? If the word restoration means something to someone, I mean, what, for example, if you ask that question, do you believe in the restoration? And they respond by saying, well, I don't think that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God. I mean, he sounds more like an adulterer. Do you let that go? I don't know.
Again, the temple, you know, I'm in a temple recommend interview. You're really not supposed to engage. That's not the time and place to engage that. You know, probably what I would say is, you know, if you want to kind of counsel about it or talk about it, and, you know, we can kind of end the interview here and counsel about that a little bit. But really, the temple recommend interview is really a straightforward, you know, do you feel like you have a testimony of the restoration? That's it. You know, but there are unit leaders that will get into the specifics, you know.
But you won't?
No, I won't.
Okay, so if you get a sense that you've got yourself a doubter in your ward and you counsel with them, how do you counsel with them? Or what do you say, I guess?
Well, I think the typical thing that a lot of leaders say is, hey, you need to pray more and read the scriptures more. But I don't think that that really solves the problem. I think there's some very good members of the church who have really, really worked hard to try to gain a testimony of the Book of Mormon or of Joseph Smith. And, you know, they prayed for years and years and years and haven't received an answer. So, again, the most important thing in this is, you know, beyond the temple recommend, is how I treat that person. When I became bishop, I made kind of a promise to myself and I suppose to God that I would do no harm. You know, kind of like the Hippocratic oath that doctors take, do no harm. And that's kind of the basis from which I operate. So I'm not going to bully somebody or coerce somebody or, you know, try to, you know, get them to feel guilty or ashamed or, you know, put them on a guilt trip and say, well, you're really not working hard enough, are you? I think, and that's the message I would want to send to that person. Yeah, it's not easy. It's hard. It's there's things that are difficult and that we don't understand and we don't feel comfortable with. And the bottom line is that I'm here with you. I don't have all the answers, but I care about you. You're my friend.
Let's say you're my bishop. I go in there.
Yeah.
And I say, okay, well, I definitely don't think Brigham Young was a prophet. I've researched the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and I have a lot of other questions. And frankly, the church's claim of authenticity just doesn't seem to resonate with me, and that causes me a lot of problems. I'm strongly considering leaving the church. What's your counsel, Bishop?
My counsel is that it would be a big loss for you to leave the church. It'd be a loss for the church. And that's how I feel about it, is that there's a lot of very, very good people, intelligent people, innovative people, a lot of liberals politically and
politically? Uh-oh.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most vulnerable parts of the church is that, you know, kind of as I've made my journey here to try to understand things, is I see those who are liberal politically, they're not finding comfort and space in a lot of wards. And it's a factor in them leaving the church. And it's not acceptable. So a lot of progressives, a lot of liberals, and some of these issues that we've got with the church and the history, you know, I think they're even starting to hit some of the moderates. So in a lot of ways, it's kind of like the canary in the coal mine. We've got to sit up and listen and try to figure out how can we work with individuals who have doubts in a respectful way, in a compassionate way, and to let them know that that's okay.
Bishop, when I was a member of the church, especially during the last few years, I became increasingly troubled by the fact that although I didn't agree with a lot of what was being said, my presence sort of implied my acquiescence or my support of these positions. And I felt the institution sort of made it so I couldn't express my dissent, even if it be loyal dissent, or my alternate opinion. As a bishop, I mean, you're even more so in a role like that. Just the momentum behind the church just implies all sorts of things that you obviously don't believe. Does that trouble you, or how do you sort of combat that?
I think that what the church goes through is going through right now is not unique. I don't think it's unique to our church. I think every single religion, every single institution, every single country, every single individual, more or less, tends to whitewash their history. And as you dig a little bit deeper into things, you're going to find, like I said, a ball rock. And so I don't think the church is unique in that. But you're right that we don't tolerate as a people or give space to being able to express concerns or doubts or questions. We've got a policy of faith promoting history, and I believe that is, you know, I understand why they put that in there, because, you know, they don't want people's faith to be harmed. But when you live in the information age, as we do, you are setting people up for a crisis of faith. When the gap, like I said, the Grand Canyon between the faith promoting history and the totality of the history is so large. And I think the brethren are starting to do, you know, they're trying to close that gap little by little, gradually. But it's very difficult, because if you go too fast, you're going to put the membership in shock, and you know, you're going to have massive defections. So how you approach it is a difficult thing, and I think all institutions and individuals and religions, they all have to come to grips with it. We have a very young religion compared to most. And it also came out around the time where we have lots of documentation about what people said, what people did, letters, sermons, discourses. So we're in a difficult position, because, you know, there's so much material and evidence out there. But, you know, you see things that the church is doing to try to close the gap, you know, such as the Joseph Smith papers, Elder Nelson giving a talk about Joseph using the hat, rough stone rolling. So some of these other things, I think, are trying to close that gap and say, hey, we need to start having a little bit more space to be able to talk about these things. But you're right. Right now, it's not very safe, is it?
I just want to go off of what you were saying about this kind of nuanced view and trying to encourage that to the members and within yourself. The problem that I see is with the church is this exclusive authority, this one and only true church concept. That makes it very difficult. Yeah, this is a young church, but the difference being most countries, most religions aren't, well, some do, some religions do claim this, but ours particularly claiming to the world, more or less, that this is it. This is, we have what Christ gave to Joseph Smith. We have exclusive priesthood power. God works through our church. And what you're saying is, okay, that's nice and all, but other religions are good too. So that nuanced view of kind of downplaying the one and only true church is good, but I don't think you can really cut that tie, can you?
Well, yeah, it's a tough one to cut that tie. But again, you know, I would probably challenge that almost every religion thinks that it's right. We have wars going on right as we speak, that where, of course, everybody thinks that they have the truth, and if you just did things my way or the way that I've been taught or my tradition, then everything would be great. So, once again, the church is not unique in making a claim that they have the truth. But you're right; it's something that's very difficult to cut that tie. I don't know how you do that exactly. But for me, something that President Hinckley said is, you know, hey, let's bring all the good that you have, and let's see if we can add to it. I think that's a great approach, that we can kind of take a look at what other people have, learn from them, bring that into the church, and make that a part of who we are. And the thing that disturbs me is that when people leave the church, that hurts the church. You know, we're losing a lot of really good people, amazing people, you know, that I've talked to and met. And a lot of them, you know, this was the thing that surprised me when I went on the board, is, you know, how I was treated. You know, and so many people would say, hey, if I just had a kind and compassionate bishop, regardless of the history, I'd be in the church today. And that really affected me, that it was not necessarily about the history and the problematic issues about it, but how it was dealt with, and that it often was dealt with in not a very kind or compassionate way. And, you know, I hear that over and over again. You know, people private messaging me, oh, I wish I had a bishop who was kind. I wish I had a bishop who was, you know, a little bit more Christ-like. I wish a bishop understood or at least listened to me. And so for me, that's the big tragedy that's going on here, is that, you know, we're not training bishops really to be compassionate or loving, or you know, we're a lot of the training that bishops, you know, do get, it's about how to get more people to the temple, how to do, you know, expand missionary work, you know, all the typical things.
Your wife is kind of aware of your goings on, right? With your doubts and some of your online activity, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she doesn't like it so much. We kind of have a little bit of a don't ask, don't tell thing. And I would, you know, again, in the church, we have this all or nothing. We're very black and white, as we're taught in the church. And, you know, so, you know, I want to say up front that my wife is not super, super ultra orthodox. You know, we all, to a certain degree or another, come up to the Mormon buffet and partake of what we want to partake. You know, some people go after the whole buffet, and some people, you know, only go after the, you know, the black olives or, you know, whatever. So, you know, we all kind of are on this continuum on the buffet, you know, whether we're, you know, the president of the church or, you know, a new member. And she, you know, she does understand some of these problematic issues with church history. But again, she's very pragmatic, and she says, you know, I feel good going to church, and I feel the Spirit often, and it works for me.
I wish, like you were saying earlier, I do wish that I had a bishop like you. Like, it would be a lot easier. I applaud your approach. Do you think you'll be able to make it to the end of your term as a bishop?
Yeah. I wasn't sure at first. I you know, when I was going through the earthquake in a diverse place, you know, I mean, it's like the end of the world. You know, it's like the signs of the times, except it's internally. But as you kind of get through that, you kind of see the dawning of an internal millennium, so to speak. And that's kind of where I'm at, where I feel, you know, I think I can make it through, and I think I can stay in the church. And I think that maybe I can do some good, that maybe there's others out there, maybe even other bishops who are, you know, have gone through what I've gone through, and, you know, just showing, again, a measure of compassion and saying, hey, you're not alone, and we can stand together and give some comfort to one another. And whether somebody chooses to leave the church or not, you know, that's their business. I don't think anybody should be the victim of coercion. I think that's satanic, quite frankly. It is completely the opposite of Jesus Christ. And when we make accusations, you know, Satan is, the word Satan means accuser. He's known as the accuser of his brethren and accuses the saints, you know, night and day. But when people, you know, leave the church, we make an accusation against them. Oh, they're probably sinning.
You've probably dealt with a lot of people that have been sinning, right? I assume that you've either held or been involved with some disciplinary courts, right?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Have you been involved with any disciplinary courts over apostasy?
No.
Is that intentional or is that just kind of coincidental?
That's coincidental. It has not come up.
Do they do that anymore? I mean, that seems a little sort of medieval.
Yeah, you know, it's something that really bothers me, as I've heard some of the people that I've met and heard some of their stories. Being hunted down for apostasy. And, like, there's this, you know, great fear that, somehow somebody's going to contaminate the doctrine of the church or hurt the church in some way. And, you know, I kind of understand it to a certain degree. If there's somebody who is, you know, filled with hatred and just wanting to, you know, really destroy people's faith or testimonies, I can kind of understand that. I really can. Because I'm not into the hatred thing. I'm not into tearing people down. I'm not down with that.
Have you ever disciplined over masturbation?
A council?
Well, maybe like disfellowship or yank someone's recommend. Like John Larson, would you rip his recommend?
Hey Tom, don't say yank when you're talking about masturbation.
Sorry.
Good one. would I take away his recommend?
Or her, I guess. Not gender specific.
Yeah. I don't really ask the question, quite frankly. No, I don't bring it up.
I mean, if they brought it up, I guess.
If they bring it up and they think it's a problem, we talk about how it may be, a positive thing for them to have a little bit more, control or, you know, self-discipline or whatever. But I don't hit them with the guilt stick about it because that's, to me, that is, when I think about that and I compare, treating somebody harshly or judgmentally or abuse, you know, actual abuse, whether it's ecclesiastical abuse or physical abuse or sexual abuse. I compare, masturbation to that. I mean, come on.
That's good to know.
You know, it kind of reminds me of what Jesus said, you know, the fact that the scribes and Pharisees were, you know, paying tithing on even the smallest, herbs that they had, you know, to kind of promote their self-righteousness. And, he said, well, what about the weightier things, you know, of justice and mercy and love? You know, and to me, you know, you're going to spend time scrutinizing people about masturbation. You know, the other thing too is the guilt and the shame of our people. You know, it's just enormous. The self-hatred, the self-loathing. That's not what we're here to do. You know, we're here to lift one another up. We're here to spiritually nourish one another. And when we turn that into such a you know, a center of focus. I don't really understand that, you know, especially with youth. You know, I don't ask the youth that question. I don't think it's appropriate, quite frankly.
Well, big time kudos to you. That's so refreshing to hear, frankly. And I know we're kind of running out of time, but kind of the same take on homosexuality.
Yeah, that's a real tough one for me because I'm very supportive of gay rights because I believe gay rights are human rights. I was listening to the news today, and there was, I believe, a death that happened either today or yesterday of a gay rights activist. So it's something that I'm very, very concerned about. You know, the amount of suicides of you know, Mormons who don't have the sexual orientation of the majority of members of the church, it's unacceptable.
I really, really, I mean, this is actually making me feel more enlightened, more positive. Like, and I'm even thinking, so my last question is for John. John, if Bishop was your local bishop, would you return?
I would enjoy being in the ward, but I still can't accept the idea of the restoration and the apostasy. So, but we need more bishops like our good bishop here. I don't mean to take away from what he's been saying at all. I mean, obviously you can hear in his voice the difficulty of these issues. And, you know, when Bishop, when you were talking about how devastating it was, I felt the same way. It took me a long time to leave the church, and it was very hard. It was something that I loved in a lot of ways. I've used the metaphor before. It was very much like having an abusive father. You know, there was a lot of negative things there, but it was still my father, and the church is still, you know, the thing that I grew up in, the thing that made me what I am in a lot of very good ways. And my heart even today breaks over the dichotomy of feelings I feel about the church and especially about its people. So, yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, you know, and that's what I found in my journeys too, that I was so shocked at is the amount of people on the, you know, the New Order Mormon board that I frequent who said, I mean, even people who have left the church who said, hang in there. Keep your calling. Go forward. Don't quit. You know, the church needs bishops like you. And that was something that was totally different than what I would have expected. I would have expected disaffected members of the church to say, dude, you get out of there.
Right.
You know, so I think, you know, again, I look at the church more than just the church. You know, I view it as our people. It's in many ways, it's almost an ethnicity. If you were to give it, you know, 1,000 more years, you'd almost have an ethnicity going on there. Maybe we already do. And so that's part of what makes it so difficult is that when you're born and raised in the church, it's, you know, it's in you. And I don't know that it goes away even after somebody leaves the church. It's still very much a part of you. And so that's what really shocked me is people saying, hey, I support you. I want you to, you know, even though I was struggling and I didn't know what to do and I was saying maybe I need to quit, people were, you know, people who had left the church were saying, hang in there. And so I think deep down there's a there's a part of people, even though, you know, you go through this horrible situation, and when you bring up the issue of abuse, you know, there is abuse in the church. But, you know, for me, I had a very positive experience growing up in the church, for the most part, and had a very positive experience at BYU, for the most part. And that's a whole nother story right there that
that's right.
I probably don't have time for. But it's kind of like, you know, when you're growing up, you know, for me, you look at your parents, and my parents were not abusive. You look at your parents, and they're your heroes. They can do no wrong. They're perfect. And then you get to this stage in life where you start to see things a little bit more clearly. You get kind of a wider lens. You're able to point out hypocrisy as a teenager. And you start to see the flaws in your parents. And it's no accident that, you know, that's a tough time for parents and teenagers. But, and that's kind of how I see my journey in the church, is I went through a phase where it was very idealistic and romanticized and perfect and shiny. And you know, the brethren were put on pedestals, and then in the information age, you come to find out that it's not perfect, and it is flawed, and there's things that are very, very difficult to deal with. So, you know, that's how I see it, is coming to grips with recognizing that your parents are not the perfect people that you may have thought.
Yeah, and especially realizing that BYU is not exactly what you thought either. So,
yes, there's people who can hunt you down there, too, if you're not following the code.
Yeah.
So, absolutely.
I think those are some excellent words to end on, Bishop. I would like to echo most of the things you said about having a more nuanced and less literal approach to the church. I think we do need more bishops like you out there, absolutely. And I do hope that you can hang in there and not quit. I would like to echo that, too. I hope that other bishops that are out there listening can take a little bit of comfort, bishops or even high council members or whoever, can take a little comfort in knowing that they're not alone, that this kind of crisis of faith can and may affect everybody at some point. But, John, the
Absolutely.
Bishop, any final words?
No, I just... you know, it's great that you're out there, and I appreciate the willingness to reach across the aisle. And you know, I think everybody on all sides of the issue are not as bad as they seem. you could help us break some of those stereotypes down.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, people that we think are villains are there's a little bit of hero in them, and people we think of as heroes, there's a little bit of villain in them. You know, we tend to, as a people, to view things in extremes, and we do need to have a more compassionate, nuanced view of all people, and especially in our church, if we do say that we follow Jesus Christ. So.
All right, excellent. Well, I've really appreciated you joining us and in this so-called a reverse bishop interview.
yeah, it's true. It's true.
And just want to remind you that the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com. You can email us at mel or email at MormonExpression, or it's mail at MormonExpression.com. Is that right?
M-A-I-L.
Yeah, not email, the mail at MormonExpression.com or John or Tom at MormonExpression.com. You can call us. Check this out, John, 801-906-6722.
All right. I don't mean to be the bad cop and all, but how do we know for sure you're a bishop?
Boy, I don't know if there's any tokens that I can give to show that I'm a bishop. I don't know. Quiz me.
I figured it'll come out in the wash. I just had to say that.
That's all right. Yeah. No, I was thinking about that question the other day. I was like, you know, I wonder if people say, hey, how do we know this guy's a bishop? So,
of course they say.
I think as we talk, you'll be able to get a sense of, you know, that I am indeed a bishop.